come together.
Thanks for listening to the KC Morning Show.
And starving amid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Tuesday, Kansas City. My name is Hartzell. Before we take back America, I wanted to take a quick second to plug Professor Harvey Kay's book. We have basically studied this thing from front to back on this show for like the last 3 years. Talking the Economic Bill of Rights from FDR today, so definitely follow along at home. What, just yesterday, A. Philip Randolph, radical labor leader, inspired MLK. He wrote a thing called the Freedom Budget for All Americans, which would have eliminated poverty in this country in the 60s and the 70s. Well, he took a lot of this inspiration from FDR's Economic Bill of Rights. If you haven't checked it out, you want to follow along, it is FDR on Democracy, the greatest speeches and writings of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, selected and introduced by Harvey J. K. The good professor. And with that, let's do this. It's your KC Morning Show. Let's take back America.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
The KC Morning Show.
On January 11, 1970, victory belonged to Hank Stram and his Kansas City Chiefs.
TV9 News Special Report, close up the flood of 77.
From the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri, it's Milwaukee Bucks against the Kansas City Kings.
Now Kansas Cityans must decide what happens next. What is to follow the city's Holy Week riots?
I am here at the American Royal World Series of Barbecue.
Daryl Motley awaits, and the Kansas City Royals are world champions. Kansas
City, Professor Harvey Kay, my brother. He is the professor emeritus over at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Tuesdays on this show, you know what we do. We take back America, reclaiming our radical, progressive, leftist history of these here United States. We got a progressive playbook. This thing is pretty damn good. Every week we try to break that down, inspire, activate, amplify, all the words. And honestly, I don't want to speak for you, Professor K, but I think we're pretty damn good at this.
You know, I have to agree with you.
So where are we in the timeline, Professor K?
It's January 11th, 1944. And so I'm now going to present the introductory paragraph from my book, FDR and Democracy, the introductory paragraph to the speech, the State of the Union speech on the Economic Bill of Rights. With the tide of war definitely moving in favor of the United States and its, in quotes, United Nations allies, that's how FDR referred to them, Roosevelt returned in his 1944 State of the Union address to his idea of creating a declaration or an Economic Bill of Rights, something that he first proposed in 1932. And also in terms of his securing the four freedoms, these two ideas of his of 32 and 41 now feed directly into this speech. After urging Americans to continue to give their all to the war effort and strongly warning them against those who might place greed above patriotism, he stated, "We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed." And he then proceeded to propose nothing less than an Economic Bill of Rights for all Americans. He did so confident that most Americans would support the idea, for surveys commissioned by the White House had indicated that the great majority, overwhelming majority of Americans definitely wanted to establish national health care, educational opportunities, and an expanded Social Security program. He also knew, however, that as much as Americans might support his call, the conservative coalition in Congress of Republicans and Southern Democrats, combined with the powerful corporate business interests, would vehemently oppose it. Nevertheless, he hoped Americans might one day secure such a Bill of Rights, an Economic Bill of Rights. So we'll move well into the speech, to the place in the speech where he introduces, or at least lays out the reasons why Americans should, that it's time we should, enact, create an Economic Bill of Rights. That reverberates to this day. To this day. Take it away, Hartzell.
It is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and determine the strategy for winning of a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. We cannot be content, no matter how high that general standard of living may be. If some fraction of our people, whether it be one-third or one-fifth or one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure, this republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights, among them the right of free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. As our nation has grown in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to ensure us equality in the pursuit of happiness. We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made.
In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these are, 1, the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. 2, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. 3, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. 4, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. 5, the right of every family to a decent home. 6, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. 7, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. And finally, 8, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, and we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being.
America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world. One of the great American industrialists of our day, a man who has rendered yeoman service to his country in this crisis, recently emphasized the grave dangers of rightist reaction in this nation. All clear-thinking businessmen share this concern. Indeed, if such reaction should develop, if history were to repeat itself and we were to return to the so-called normalcy of the 1920s, then it is certain that even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefield abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home.
FDR's words, by the way, speak directly to our day. Let's make that clear. I continue. We continue. I ask the Congress to explore the means for implementing this economic Bill of Rights, for it is definitely the responsibility of the Congress so to do. Many of these problems are already before committees of the Congress in the form of proposed legislation. I shall from time to time communicate with the Congress with respect to these and further proposals. In the event that no adequate program of progress is evolved, I am certain that the nation will be conscious of the fact. Our fighting men abroad and their families at home expect such a program and have the right to insist upon it. It is to their demands that this government should pay heed rather than to the whining demands of selfish pressure groups who seek to further their nests while young Americans are dying. The foreign policy that we have been following, the policy that guided us at Moscow, Cairo, and Tehran, is based on the common sense principle which was best expressed by Benjamin Franklin on July 4, 1776. We must all hang together, or assuredly, we shall all hang separately.
I have often said that there are no two fronts for America in this war. There's only one front. There's only one line of unity which extends from the hearts of the people at home to the men of our attacking forces in our farthest outpost. When we speak of our total effort, we speak of the factory and the field and the mine as well as the battlefield. We speak of the soldier and the civilian, the citizen, and his government. Each and every one of us has a solemn obligation under God to serve this nation in its most critical hour, to keep this nation great, to make this nation greater in a better world.
Hear, hear. I want to point out to people that in the months that followed this speech, FDR was relatively quiet, politically speaking. But these words were not quiet. They did not go on the shelf. Labor unions, both the labor unions of the American Federation of Labor and the labor unions of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, as well as the National Farmers Union and a new organization, the National Progressive Citizens Action Coalition, or something to that effect. I'm blanking on the actual name right now. They all literally fought a campaign. They spent money. They rallied, they produced pamphlets and radio programs to promote the idea of a second Bill of Rights. Americans wanted it. As I said, FDR had commissioned surveys, polling that showed Americans wanted this. But of course, he was right. There were going to be enemies of the idea. One, Southern Democrats who feared it would bring about integration. Two, Republicans who, by the way, actually moved many of them in favor of possibly even national health care, as FDR was proposing, but they couldn't quite bring themselves to do it ultimately. The greatest danger that FDR was referring to here when he said rightist reaction wasn't even from the Ku Kluxers or folks like that. It was from the big corporate bosses who did not want to create a social democratic America, what FDR would call a more liberal America, but really it was social democracy that was being expressed in this speech. Nevertheless, as I said on another occasion, even though he dies several months later, not after the speech, but several months after he wins the presidency in November 44, the words he expressed and the arguments he made and the vision that he projected or promised become a part of the labor movement for years to come, even the Democratic Party platforms for some time, which makes it all the more tragic and sad that we don't see it in the Democratic Party platform speeches.
Let me ask you this. We didn't actually prep for this part, but here we are 80 years later. What excites you, but also are you worried that we're going to lose some of that spirit?
Actually, let me answer your question in a way that I meant to tell you. Obviously, we're thrilled by the success of the UAW, the prior success of the Teamsters, the energies and efforts of Starbucks workers across the country, the effort by Chris Smalls at the Amazon warehouse and his union now seeking to get more energy around the country for the labor organizing drive. Here's my concern at the same time that I'm thrilled. I think it's imperative for labor, the labor movement that is so resurgent right now, to not only organize, rev up all the engines for contract negotiations, collective bargaining, winning power back from the bosses, helping to redistribute income by winning better contracts. I think it's imperative that the labor movement embrace the economic Bill of Rights idea. The labor movement has to speak not only for the workers who are organized and capable of pursuing industrial democracy, they should speak for all working people in America. Americans want an economic Bill of Rights. The surveys have been done. The polling shows Americans want health care. They want an active voice in the workplace. They want a guarantee to a job. They want to be able to pursue an education, public education, as far as their capacities and abilities and talents will take them. They want all of the things included in the Economic Bill of Rights that Alan and I, together, working from the historical examples in the past, projected, that Marianne Williamson has taken on, that has been embraced by some legislators up in New Hampshire, and a bill is before the New Hampshire legislature, has been embraced by the West Virginia Democratic Party Executive Board, has been embraced by the Massachusetts Democratic Party, by the Arizona Democratic Party. California is moving in that direction. I don't think it's official yet, however. So the energy is there. It's striking. The ideas are there. But for things to happen, I believe it requires the energy and commitment of a dynamic labor movement. And it's that very idea of an economic Bill of Rights that can afford not only a greater, if you like, impulse to the labor movement, but literally help to bring about the progressive transformation, the redemption of the promise of America and the democratic spirit that we all feel but has not yet been fully arrived at.
Professor Harvey J.K., that was beautiful. Happy anniversary. Where can folks find you on the internet?
At Harvey J.K., H-A-R-V-E-Y, initial J-K-A-Y-E. And where can they find you, Hartzell?
They can get me at Hartzell965. That's H-A-R-T-Z-E-L-L. Two L's. I realize I should really start spelling this thing out, you know?
Yes, you should.
Hartzell965. You can get the show, The KC Morning Show, at KC Morning Show, or on Instagram at The KC Morning Show. We're in election year, Harvey K. It's time to get to work. Time to continue our work.
Yes, time to take back America all the more effectively.
Looking in the eye, tell me I'm satisfied.